said, the Congress obviously intended that after 1991, some Native people, perhaps many Native people, might decide to sell their shares to non-Natives. That's the way Congress set it up. And they intended, I think, that Eskimos would sell their shares, they'd get money for their shares, they'd go out and buy a snowmobile or put a new roof on their house, or they might take the money and buy shares in General Motors or Chrysler Corporation, because Congress felt that Eskimos and Aleuts and Indians should become part of the whole American corporate and commercial system. And they thought that that was the best thing to do. And they said, all right, we'll give you 20 years to kind of get these corporations going. After that, though, the shares that you hold will go on the market. Other people can buy them. That's what they intended, and it's becoming quite apparent at these hearings around the state that that Alaska Natives don't want to see that outcome. They want to see the land continue in Native hands and passed on to their future generations, just as Marie Schwind said a minute or two ago. You said, well, who would be controlling and running these corporations 70 years from now? Well, if the law isn't changed, I think it's fair to say that these corporations in 70 years' time will certainly not be run by Eskimos, and they won't be controlled by Eskimos or Indians or Aleuts. I just don't think there's any doubt about that. That's why people are concerned and apprehensive and feel that changes have to be made before 1991. There's another thing that's been raised here, though, that you should think about, and the way Congress set this up, one generation of Native people, those alive in 1971, received shares. And they can leave their shares to their children or to anybody they want if they write a will. But that means that, and somebody mentioned this morning, if you have 100 shares and you have 10 children, and then leave your shares to your children, each of your children will get 10 shares. If somebody else has one child, just one child, leaves their shares to that one child will have 100 shares. So in the second generation under ANCSA, you can have very great inequalities in shareholding, because you can have people in the second generation holding 10 shares, others holding 100 shares. Maybe the person who's got 100 shares, maybe their aunt leaves them 100 shares, they wind up with 200. In the third generation, you could have even more disparities. And in some corporations, they have people who now hold less than one share. And I think you have to think about that, because that means as the shares descend from one generation to the next, the shareholdings, which started out equally, everybody had 100 shares or 200 shares back in 1971, by the end of the century, you could have people with widely varying shareholdings. And it seems to me only a question of time before somebody who's got 200 or 300 shares starts to say, well, I should have a lot more power in this corporation. I should have a lot more to say about what goes on here than somebody who's only got one share or half a share. And that's something that you have to think about it. I know that one of the AFN resolutions tries to come to grips with that issue. And at the roundtable we're having in Anchorage next week, we hope to be discussing that. It's the way corporations are set up. It's the way shares are bought and sold in corporate America. And you may think it isn't exactly the way you want shares to be divided among you.
I'm Danny Thomas, and I work for Manilik Association as a prevention specialist or regional outreach supervisor. And I traveled to 11 villages, and I've seen a lot of things happen this past few years. And in fact, ever since I was going to school, when I was going to grade school, in the 1940s, it was a time of a lot of hunting, a lot of game that was we had a lot of games. In Buckland, we had 300,000 head of reindeer. And within a year's time, they were all lost due to storm and caribou's taking them away. And I saw a lot of changes, even at my young age. I know that we were in a transition, and we'd have to adapt ourselves. And I have seen our elders adapt to a lot of the changes that came in their lives. And even though we're in a dual culture, they have made the most of the changes. There have been a lot of rules and regulations that have been imposed on them without their knowledge, without even being contacted. Like the Fish and Game set up rules and regulations without even considering the natives that were being affected by them. And today we're going through another transition from now till 1991 about corporate structure, about shares, and about the land and the different aspects of land involvement, like taxes on the land. And these are areas that we'll have to educate ourselves in. And if we don't, we'll be setting ourselves out on a limb. And I'm like most everyone say, I don't know much about ANCSTA, because ANCSTA was set up without even considering the natives in our area. It was set up so fast that we didn't have time to consider any portion that was affecting us in our land and our lifestyle. Like, I'm a full-blooded Eskimo, and I went to school in Mount Edgecombe. And at least once a month, my mother used to send me some Nikkapak, muktuk, and dried meat. And in order to make it last, I used to hide it in a cellar just to have it once in a while by myself and a friend. And that wasn't the way our forefathers lived, because they shared everything. Like, when I was a young boy, the first game that I got of any kind went to an elder, so that the elder could ask blessings on us. And it was the way of our life. Today, our young children don't know anything about that. They get some game and they brag about it, and then they don't get the blessings that our culture had normally it was normal for our culture. And these are areas that, you know, we have to consider, that how will our children really be affected in 1991? I got four children that were born after 1971, and even they're full-blooded Eskimos. They are not shareholders, and in a way, it really affects them. Why am I different, they ask, than my brother? Or why am I different from you? And we have to contend with these. We have to try to make them understand that these are rules and regulations that we live by. Maybe if we have an opportunity to take part in making these rules and regulations through the workshops and through the proposals that are set up by AFN, I think a lot of these could be answered. But one thing is, we as natives have to be considered, because it is our lives, it is our lifestyle, it is our culture that we are dealing with. A lot of us are losing our culture. When I was growing up in the school, if I so much as spoke a word of Eskimo, I'd be put in a corner for a period of time. And there was different punishments that we had to go through. Maybe the second time I'd have to stay in the school during lunch hour. But, you know, I have a lot of admiration for our native people, because they were able to match up to the changes that affected their lives, just like the game laws that were set up. One year, a limit was put on one caribou per hunter. And after having meat all year, all winter, it was a hardship for a lot of people. And it wasn't this type of a lifestyle we had been raised up with. And when we go out, like beluga hunting at Elephant Point, our hunting style is completely different than it was as I was growing up as a youngster, because we were able to hunt and get the food that was needed within the village. And those that didn't get any, we'd share with them, so that they would have some. Today it's so different. Everybody's for themselves. Just like Marie mentioned, they want this for their own mind. This is my land, my game. But you know, if we just reflect back and go back to the way we were raised up, if we could show our younger generations by example how our culture really was, we could bring back some of it. I know we can't bring it all back, but in order to maintain our identity as natives, we have to learn to share like we were taught when we were younger. And in 1991, when we have our land allotments allocated to us, how is the tax situation going to be for us? We that never, our ancestors who never had taxation before, who was free to roam and hunt at will, follow the games that were there, it's really going to be a different lifestyle completely than what we have been brought up with. You know, I'm very thankful that as a young student in the in the elementary school, I saw the changes that were done in the Indian lifestyle in the lower 48. And my dad didn't want me to go high school, and I said, things are changing, they won't always be the same. We gotta educate ourselves in order to be able to survive. And if we could instill into our children the desire to learn more about Angska and what's going to happen in the future, I'm sure that a lot of these problems that we have could be solved. And the shares that we are so worried about, if we could have the Congress help us to work out the shares in such a way that they could be kept in the family or in the village corporation. I'm sure that we'll never lose control if we so desire. We just have to show our interest in our culture and our heritage as Eskimos.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
I'm back here again. Tom Yangtagook. A lot of time when we first make testimony, it's either in a little bit of anger, and it's either a reflective mood. And second time, when you get off that first testimony, then you think about, this is what I should have said. Then second time around, you're a little bit more positive. Then you begin to add something more positive. Your anger is expelled the first time around, so I'm glad you give it a second chance. So for this reason, I'm back up here again, because I'd like to put in some positive note to what I just said last time. Mine was a very angry letter, in a way, because of all those years of abuse and that we have to put up with. But now, first of all, this country, in spite of all the anger that I have, my 22 years of service, I have two type of feelings. I have a traditional feeling of pride. Then I learned to have pride in the flag. Every time I see that flag, I'm very proud, because as a military, I learned to salute that flag and what it stood for. And this country, in spite of all its problems, and its, in spite of all its problem, I wouldn't trade it for anything, because I've been all over the world. And just right across the from here, this Iron Curtain. And do they have this kind of hearing like we do? That's a very good question, isn't it? Do they have the kind of hearing that we have? We have it. I think we're really blessed that we can come out and speak against this country. And they gave us opportunity, and then to straighten out some of those things. And so now, what I want to say, every time I want to go camping, a lot of time when we go, before we go camping, we take inventory of what we need without even thinking about it, because we're so used to what we need to survive out in camping. But in different area, I think now what I need to say here, this is a time to take inventory of what we have, already have. We've gone this far, so far without realizing it, how far we have gone into meeting these challenges. And they've done the marvelous job. Here goes the bell again. We have this bell to interrupt us, give us the sentence and comma. So this is one big comma again. And so I think this is time to take inventory of what we have. We need to take a very careful inventory of what we already have and what we have already achieved to meet that challenge ahead of us. And I think we have a lot of good assets. We have people that have been learning to become corporate leaders. And we have people, young people, that are becoming educated. And when Paul was born in California, and I was stationed over there in Japan, and they were stationed overseas, I didn't realize or didn't conceive that he would become a lands claim expert. He spoke this morning. So we have that kind of positive assets now, and they're coming up very rapidly. So we need to look at what we have, and there we have a lot of good brains here, and then use them together to achieve what we need to accomplish for that 1991 change. We're looking for something in the future already, but what we need to do is take inventory of what we already have and start from there, just like camping. A lot of time before I go on a long trip, I take inventory of what I need. Now this is the time to take inventory. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, sir. Well, maybe we'll, it's 3 o'clock, maybe we'll just take a break. Okay, we will take a break in a minute then. Yep, please do.
My name is Paula Anderson. I am a NANA and KIC shareholder, a permanent resident of Kotzebue. This is my personal testimony. I speak not only for myself, but for us as natives, as a whole. Under the Native Allotment Act of 1906, many people were unable to apply for the 160 acres you would think they were entitled to while attending school or serving time in the Vietnam War. Many were not aware of the land availability, but knew the land as being theirs, and so they thought would be theirs, only to find that the land would be taken due to inevitable use of land or proper filing prior to December 1971. I was aware of the Native Allotment Act and wanted some land then but could not get any. I don't think I even knew how to pitch up a tent then, save the fact that I could inherit some had a Native allotment been applied for. Where will our new Native stand come 1991? What do we do now as a whole to protect our corporate lands, either through a land bank or sharing, can make all the difference for them. So far, the only advantage they have had in playing a part is receiving the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. How can they as natives play a part in being a village and regional shareholder with the same rights we ourselves have as being shareholders? Where I stood under the Native Allotment Act is where our new natives stand now as being children of shareholders under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The 1991 issues at hand must be made clear to our native people, for the decisions made can affect us as shareholders and our children adversely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll take a 5 minute coffee break, and then if anybody else wants to speak after that, we'll still have time this afternoon, and then of course this evening at 6 at the Senior Center. This evening at 6 at the Senior Center, we'll resume the hearings then with the older folks. Thanks very much.
Hello, I think Tom summed it up pretty good on going in for a second, but it's during the day and I would like to present it in a little different form of my ideas. And long before I got involved with land claims, or when I was beginning to learn some of the system of the Western world is I had my ways of looking at it, and my understanding was different. And one way that I first learned how to do was by writing poetry. And when I first learned the system, this is what my view was of the Western system. And the title of my poem is No Way. White people told me to learn their way and told me it was here to stay. I tried, but I never did have a say. I was only turned to a model clay. They promised me of something far away, but will I play? They gave us Christian names such as Bill, Will, and Ray. I told myself our culture is fading away, but today is my day. I will only tell them, no way. This is how I look at the Western system when I first seen it and I began to start understanding it. But as I progress and my understanding of myself began to increase, I wrote this poem. Is that it was 1979 and I was just back from college and start teaching. Not only that, I was teaching it to my students in the classroom. And I was trying to imply this to them as well. Proud to be an Inupiaq, nothing to be ashamed of being Inupiaq, because I learned to be an Inupiaq. Real people, they call us the Inupiaqs. Stories told over and over of the Inupiaqs, strong and healthy, our culture was said, the Inupiaqs. Education we learn, but we are still Inupiaqs. We act, think different, but the color and the skin is still Inupiaq. Since birth to the end, always proud to be an Inupiaq. This is what I began to start perceiving myself as. And I was proud of it. And as I learned and understand the land claims, I began to start wondering whose land. Because all of a sudden I hear everybody saying, my land. Before the land claims, it was our land. The land claims come around, everybody began to start identifying their land and saying, this is my land. And so the title of my poem is, Whose Land? We live in this land for thousands of years. Living in it, we were happy, but sometimes we had tears. How could you do this to us? We said to our peers, D2, land claims, issues we listen with ears. But government, state, wants all land digging with spurs. Must they kill us with our own spears? God made this land for all people to live without any fears. And this one was Nana. Inupiaqs live here who never learn how to spear. People born and die but never disappear. Living in harmony with nature will never fear. But land claims did it all. Now we must stand tall, rigid, and never to fall. Forefather spirits, hope they will never call. Younger generation wearing bandana. Long winters, but we never go banana. To pass time, we often visit Kayana. Proud to be born from this region, Nana. Now, what I would like to do is tell you a story. About 3-4 years ago, I went to Anchorage, and the people that took me to the workshop down there, gave me a lodging right near 4th Avenue. And I stayed down there for a week for this workshop. It was toward the springtime. And after I stayed down there for a while, I began to start, as I watched during the day or sometimes in the evening out my window, I felt sorry for the people that I knew out in Fourth Avenue because they were stuck. They were just like people that got bitten by a Dracula. I don't know what part of them are in their neck, like the movie always go, but some part of them got stuck in there. In other words, they couldn't move. And I look at them with, how can I help them? But as I stop and think about it, there was hardly anything that I can do, much less it had to take more than myself. And I was coming back and in the plane, and I was remembering what I seen down in the Fourth Avenue. And I began to I had this idea about writing a story. And my story is the Los Inupiaq. And like this individual, we must not get trapped into the Western society or into the system to so much to where we can't get out of it. It's just like I know when we were small, we used to see mouse traps. We used to try to bait the mouses to the trap so they can eat it. The minute it takes a bite, bang, it gets it right on the neck. So this is what we got to keep in mind as well. Despite all the things that we have amongst us, is that we always have to try to determine our future. We have to check out our footsteps ahead of us, meaning we don't just go in there walking. Then all of a sudden somebody hits you or knock you down, then you realize where you stepped into. So this is what we got to do, is we got to look beyond the horizon. Because when you look into the horizon, you think that's the end, but it's not. You walk to the horizon again, and there is another horizon. And you can go all the way around the world in this manner. And if we can look at it at that aspect, we'll be better off. Otherwise, we'll get too caught up in one simple thing or one matter or one problem. We got to look at it from all angles. Once upon a time, there was this Inupiaq that was out hunting, and he was very good hunter. And his family needs were always met. And his family didn't go hungry because he was a good hunter. And he went to all different areas of the country. He went to the Athabascan country. He went to the Yupi country. And somebody said he even went down to the southeastern part, like in Anchorage, around that area. But it wasn't Anchorage then. But it was just country. So he went very, very far. Probably went even to Canada and Siberia and those different areas that he visited. So this person didn't stay very close. But one day he stopped at this village, which was quite peculiar to him because he was welcomed by people. Some were staggering, some were laughing, some were talking. And he said, wow, what kind of people are these? And another thing that he noticed, they were all white. And he thought something scared the daylights out of them. Or either that they've been out in the cold weather for so long that they turned white, but he didn't know who they were, but he wasn't going to bother to find out who they were. So after he looked around the area, he went to this house because he wanted to warm up. And as he walked inside to this building, it was the noisiest and the loudest building a place that he'd gone into. All the people there welcomed him, and they were sit there, come over here, sit over here. Everybody was laughing. Everybody was good, having a good time. Music was going full blast, and it was real smoky inside. And they sat him up in the bar and set him down. He said, well, you must be cold, and we'll give you something to drink. He said, give him one. When the person hollered, give him one, and he sat there and smiled, and this person walked up to him and gave him a glass. Not knowing what it is, he went over there and took a drink. Scared him. He went over there and he said, wow, what is this right here? He set it down and he thought they were doing a voodoo number on him. He set it back and he began to start getting scared and left, because at that time the shamans were real strong around where he lived. So he thought this is what they were trying to do to him. So he left the community and he went back home. After days and months and years went by, back in his mind, he began to start thinking about this place again, of what he had seen. So the nagging or the problem began to bother him more and more, to where his desire to go to this place got stronger and stronger and stronger. And as he couldn't stop thinking about this problem, he decided one day, well, he's going to go visit this place again. So he told his family that he was going on an extended trip, that he was going to go hunt for a long period of time. And as he began to leave, he went over there and he told his parents or his family not to worry about him, because he's going to hunt and he's going to bring home some fantastic game that they never seen before. Because prior to that, they didn't worry about him because he's been all over the country and a long period of time. So as this man left, he took off to this village. And the same welcome he got this time, he decided to go on further to discover really what these people were doing. He went inside there again. He went into this building and everybody was hollering, screaming like they did before. And as they offered him the first cup that they gave him the first time, he decided to drink it all this time. And wow, after the second one, his stomach was feeling warm. And all of a sudden, he started laughing himself. You know, he's just an Eskimo. He didn't know what was going on. And after about the third one, he said, wow, man, he was talking away in a corner by himself, speaking in your back, and everybody else was talking different language. Who cares? Nobody listened to him anyway. But he was having a good time, man. All of a sudden, he knew then why everybody was having a good time. So he just kept on drinking whatever they were giving him. It was good. And he didn't stop one time to stop and think about what it could do to him afterwards, because he never did try it before. Then pretty soon he didn't know what he was doing. In the morning he woke up and he said, wow, whatever that was good. But now it's not any good anymore, because he was feeling sick by then. But see, he didn't want to go back, because he met some friends and he had to go back and visit them. So he walked back over there. It wasn't noisy. But as he went back, he went there and sat around, waited around, and all his friends that he had night before weren't so generous with him. And as he sat there, toward the evening, more and more people began to start coming around. And pretty soon, he got addicted. He didn't know why he couldn't get away from that community, but he knew every night he had to go to that place. Every morning, he began to start looking for that hot stuff. Man, if he called it hot tang, he could have been rich. But anyway, he continuously to go there every single day, and without realizing it, he got trapped. Finally, after staying there for about 3-4 years, he figured that he stayed long enough. Not only that, he was sober enough one day to realize and understand where he had been, or what had affected him, or what got him caught in there. And he took off back home. But before he left, he looked around the community, and even before he knew it, there were a lot of other people amongst him from his own hometown, and other people that can understand him, speak Inupiaq. Then he looked around and he saw many other people go through the same steps that he did. When he finally sobered up, he went over there and began to try to tell the people, hey, you gotta leave this community. You gotta leave these things, what they give you. You gotta leave this water that they give you. It doesn't make you feel good. For a while it does. But it was too late. All these other people were trapped just like him. Then after he stayed there for a while, tried to convince other people to leave and to go home. Because what he see amongst those people, they were very good hunters, strong people, good wives, good children, and they left those. But still yet, they rather stick into this place right here. Then he felt, well, if I can't get these here, I might as well go on home and make sure those people that have not tried this yet to not do it. So as he went home, he began to start telling the people of where he have been and what he have done, and in hopes that the ones that did not have tried it yet, that will never have the opportunity to try it, or if they are going to, at least they will know what to expect when they get there. Now, how many of us fall into this category? How many of us fall into this in your loss in your pack, and how many more are going to be in that manner? And see, people, we must not fall into this trap. It's not only alcohol that have trapped us, but there are many things. There are the Western system that we can talk about this trap right here. It's like a pit. It's like a trap. And once you get in there, it's very, very hard to get in there. It's easy to get there, but it's hard to remove yourself from that place. So what we must do, we must use this as an example to determine what's ahead of us. Make sure that we know where we are stepping. Make sure what we know what's ahead of us. We must make sure and ask question, why are they giving it to us? If that in your back had stopped and asked him, I said, okay, what are you giving me? Before he took a drink, maybe it could have prevented him from all that hardships. So this is what we have to do. And with that, I think we can do many, many things like our generations before us or after us. Because they survived the harshest climate. Only thing we're trying to do now is we're trying to survive a different environment or different things, different type of problems. If our grandfathers were right now, is that they would have a lot of wisdom. But a lot of it is that we have to take upon ourselves to try to solve, because the problems are different. We have Western ideas that are on here. We have the education system. We got different type of things within the community that we have to solve, and they are still going to continue to change. When you and our children are become adults, and if they're going to try to survive as considered in your packs, something have to change, or they will change their lifestyle, or they have to do something in order to solve their problem as well. So with this story, I would like to encourage our people, our fellow Inupiaqs, that I hope that we can look to the horizon and beyond before we make our decisions right away. Thank you.